This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday with Christmas just a few weeks away. It's time to talk about holiday baking. A few weeks, just a week away. We reached out to a Wisconsin baker to share her favorite holiday cookie recipes. We're talking now about baking during the holidays, especially in the cookie realm. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite holiday cookies to make? To eat? Do you have memories of holiday cookies you ate as a kid? You make the same ones now as a grown-up. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Punky Egan is a certified master baker. She's the former lead instructor for baking and pastry arts at Madison College. Punky, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me. You've just kind of interrupted my cookie baking today, but that's okay.
All right. What have you been baking so far today?
Oh, well, I have some pecan fingers that I baked and some shortbread cookies. And I can go over those recipes with you. And I do like the little cookie press, the little spritz cookies. So if you looked in my freezer right now, you wouldn't find much food, but boy, you'd find racks of cookies.
And that's something you sent over, those recipes. We're going to take a look at them. A lot of these Christmas cookie recipes can be frozen in advance. How well does that work?
Oh, it's terrific. I mean, I start my Christmas baking right after Thanksgiving. The doughs easily keep for a couple of months in the freezer. And even when I make them and bake them, they will still last a good 6 weeks in the freezer. So you can space your cookie baking out so that you don't feel rushed at the last minute. And you always have fresh cookies then to take right out of the freezer.
I'm trying to picture in your freezer, are there containers with like a big glob of cookie dough, or are they like in individual cookies ready to throw on the rack?
Well, I have some of each, and I have half sheet pans in my freezer, and I just stack them up. So I sometimes I have to even look. I'm not sure what I have and what I've baked. So I try to keep a little record of it because I can get overboard.
Do you ever find last year's frozen dough in the freezer?
Luckily, no, I haven't. Excellent. But I do like to make some tiny little tartlets, and I make that dough year-round. So every once in a while, I do find a little of that tart dough left over, but it's still good.
Excellent. Well, you are making some of your favorites today, and you shared some of those recipes. We have them up at WPR.org/Food Friday for anybody who's looking for a recipe, maybe for this weekend. That's WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start with those shortbread cookies you mentioned. It's a classic. Tell us what goes into your shortbread.
Well, I'd like to keep it very simple and plain, and then just accentuate it with a different flavor. So it's a butter, sugar, some vanilla, eggs, and flour. And then from that, I can make three to four different kinds of cookies. So for instance, I make a little pinch cookie, and then I put a little bit of, you can make whatever you want, jam or pie filling, lemon curd, and you can put that in the middle and you pinch the two, you cut them out into squares and you pinch the two diagonal sides together, and you can see the filling coming, and it's a cute little cookie. And then also I just make some plain, I put lemon oil in, and then I can make a nice little scalloped cookie, and I love that. And then of course chocolate. This is a really dense chocolate cookie, and it has a little bit of espresso powder in. Ooh. So it just has a really nice, complex chocolate flavor.
Now, I know sometimes with baking, we got to be a little fussy about, you know, the temperature of our butter or how much we mix. Any little tips that are going to make sure the shortbread comes out right? Or is it friendly enough that even Rob can pull it off?
Oh, my gosh. That's why I chose these recipes. They're very simple. They're pretty foolproof. I mean, you're just creaming the sugar, and it doesn't matter if you cream it a minute or 3 minutes. You're just trying to incorporate it all together. So it's a pretty fail-proof recipe.
Talking to Punky Egan, certified master baker, former lead instructor for baking and pastry arts at Madison College. It's Food Friday. We're talking about baking holiday cookies. Very timely conversation. If you've got some Christmas cookies in the oven right now, love to hear from you. If you need some advice or you just want to share a favorite, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ben is with us in Atoma. Ben, hi.
Hi. We just wanted to share some of our favorite cookies ever are oatmeal, like a good chewy oatmeal cookie with that like dark brown sugar or molasses flavor. And we're actually working on our own recipe. And I was wondering, we're using browned butter in it. And I know a lot of cookies use like room temperature butter, but our cookies are spreading a lot when we bake them. So I was wondering if you could help us work out how we can get them to be a little firmer and less spready.
Oh, interesting. Any advice to keep those cookies, those oatmeal cookies, from spreading out, Punky?
Well, have you tried them first with just regular butter, Ben? Because then you can determine if it's the brown butter that's the issue.
Oh, all right.
But if you don't want to do that, sometimes you might have too much baking soda or baking powder. The leavening can cause a lot of spread. Or if your oven is too cold, a lot of times people set their oven to say 350 and they have no idea if that oven really is that accurate. So I always recommend an oven thermometer, because you do want to get these cookies to be baked at a higher temperature, because that will control the spread too. The hotter the temperature, the less spread.
Excellent. Ben, three ideas for you and your home kitchen lab to test out there. Love to hear how it turns out and if one of those is what solves it for you. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to check out, Punky, one of the other cookies you've already mentioned you're baking today. We've got your recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday, the pecan fingers.
Oh, these are one of my favorites. This recipe I have is probably 30 years old. And they're so classic, and yet they're so delicious. You wouldn't think just such a few amount of ingredients would make such a nummy cookie. And if you don't like pecans or you don't have pecans, you can use finely chopped walnuts. Would make a really nice cookie also. And this is a great one for the kids, because they're rolling it out, and it gives them something to do. It doesn't matter what the size is. I always say finger size, but if somebody wants to make them a little bit bigger, or so it's just kind of fun to work with. And then I do not put the powdered sugar on them before I freeze them. I always wait until I thaw them out, because what will happen, the powdered sugar will be absorbed by the cookie when they're in the freezer. So you have to finish them last when you take them out of the freezer.
Again, you can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sue is with us by Delavan. Sue, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Sue?
Well, I make the spritz cookies every year, and sometimes they come out cleanly from the cookie press, and sometimes they're a gooey mess. And I'm just wondering if it's the recipe I add cream cheese into my dough. But sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, Sue. Is it right away when you start making the cookies that they get, or do they get softer as you get further along with your cookies? Because the dough could maybe get too soft on you.
Right. I know it says to refrigerate the dough, but I've made them when I don't refrigerate it, and they work fine. And sometimes, I don't know, is it a temperature thing, or is it the
So butter? You're having an issue getting them out of the press?
Out of the press, yeah. And onto the cookie sheet cleanly.
Oh, okay. And your cookie sheet, you have it greased, or you have like a sill pat, or what do you have for them?
A nonstick baking sheet.
Okay. I had a little problem, in fact, with mine this year. And I only make them at Christmas time, so I forget. So I have to make some notes to myself. But I found that when I fill my cookie press, I really have to press it in tight. And you want to do that, because if there are any little air pockets at all, you're not going to get that clean cookie out. So you want to take your time to just really kind of smash it in your cookie press if you can.
Excellent. Hope that helps. Sue, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. We have Punky's Cream Cheese Spritz recipe along with those others at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Master Baker Punky Egan about holiday cookies. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have advice to share or advice you need from our guest? Do you have things cooking today, or do you have plans to bake over the weekend? What is your favorite kind of Christmas cookie, holiday-themed cookie? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with certified master baker Punky Egan about some great holiday cookie recipes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What kind of holiday cookies do you have to have on the table this time of year? Which ones do you love to bake? Which ones do you have to have but hate to bake because they're a pain? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your favorites, your advice, or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can find recipes from Punky at WPR.org/Food Friday. All right, Punky, you gave us simple recipes, but you're getting kids involved. I want to go to the opposite extreme. Because I saw a recipe on your website, actually. Years back, we said to our kids, hey, each of you pick a thing you want to bake, and we'll help you bake it. One of my daughters picked macarons because she watched baking shows, right, on the TV. And one of the most notoriously difficult cookies to make. They came out tasting okay. They weren't, I guess, the right texture for macarons. Any advice if somebody wants to try this advanced cookie skill?
Oh, well, if you have patience and you have a lot of almond flour, I say go for it. You know, it's the most fun you can have and spending not a lot of money. The main thing is you want to make sure you whip your egg whites and sugar correctly. That's, I think, the hardest part. Some people tend to over whip and some people tend to not whip it enough. It has to be kind of just stiff peaks, but not beyond that. And then when you fold that egg white mixture into your flour, which is almond flour and some more sugar, powdered sugar, you want to just fold that very gently. It has to be all incorporated, but it also still has to be slightly runny. And that's kind of the key too. If it's too stiff, you'll have peaks and it will crack. And if it's too runny and soft, you'll have pancakes. So it's kind of one of these just right. And they're fun because you can flavor the fillings so many different and color the macarons. I mean, just it's a fun cookie to make. Like I said, if you have patience and are a little detail oriented, put it that way.
And it sounds like maybe some practice might make perfect, so we get a feel for how much to whip the egg whites
absolutely.
And sugar.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. I love it. Let's get into your recipes now. You're using weights in grams in a lot of cases instead of what people might see, and especially by volume. Why do you do it that way?
Well, you know, I did because I know so many people pull recipes off the internet now, and really international recipes and all the standardized recipes are starting to go to grams. They've kind of bypassed even our pounds and ounces. And really a cup with a volume weight measure is so inaccurate because a cup of flour, it will weigh around 4 ounces, but sometimes you might end up packing it so tight that you might have 4.5 ounces in. So measurement, the weight is always will give you the most correct measurement, but pounds and ounces, I think that's harder for people to use than grams. I think grams are very friendly. And we don't have to know the translation from, you know, pounds and ounces to grams. We just need to know to set our scale. So that's why I love grams.
And I've heard from a lot of bakers, do it by weight, not by volume. How big an investment is a little kitchen scale in grams?
Oh,
it's not going to subtract that much,
no.
Right?
No, $20 and $30. No, it's a great, and they're battery operated. They're small. You can store them easily. No, it's a wise investment.
We are talking about
plus the holidays. Put that on your list.
Put that on the last minute baking or a gift list for the bakers. We know. I love it.
That's right.
It is Food Friday. We're talking about baking holiday cookies. We have Punky Egan with us, Wisconsin's own certified master baker, former lead instructor for baking and pastry arts at Madison College. Still time for your calls or comments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you need some baking advice, you can share your cookie traditions this time of year. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Lucia on Facebook. Lucia says, my favorite cookies to make are chocolate chip. I've taken the vanilla away and replaced it with maple syrup. In so doing, I've decreased the brown sugar and white sugar from 3/4 cup to 1/2 cup each. So what my grandkids ask for at Christmas and birthdays, it really warms my heart. Box went out today. We'll get to the Monday for them to enjoy. Wow, I tend, Bunky, to go with your basic straight up on the Toll House bag recipe when I make chocolate chip cookies. This sounds like an interesting substitution.
Well, you know what's so fun about it? She only makes it for Christmas and birthdays. So it makes it so special. And I think that's why I love the holiday baking so much, because I only drag out these recipes for this time of the year. So I so look forward to tasting them. And then after the holidays, I think, okay, put those recipes away and I'll take them out next year.
Now, what
so
I love
that's
about
a good idea.
What I love about this is maple syrup instead of the vanilla. The price of vanilla went through the roof a couple years back. I don't think it's settled down yet. That sounds like a nice a bargain flavoring to me.
Well, and yes, it's going to be a liquid sugar. So I would think that the cookies would be a little softer, but I think the flavor would be terrific.
All right. And we heard from Pat and Allenton, who just asked if you could say again what a cup of flour should weigh.
Well, it depends if it's all-purpose or cake flour or bread flour. So you have anywhere between approximately 4 ounces, 4 1/4 ounces to almost 5 ounces. That's why it's such a hard measurement to say, because when you say flour, we can get 3 different varieties here in this in the States. So I'm thinking that's, again, the scale is a much better weight, an accurate rate than a volume cup. And you know that some of the cups that you have, they are not a true cup even.
Really?
So that's the other problem And so if somebody has a cup measure and they consistently have bad results, it could be that that cup measurement is off.
Great. Something else to worry about. Okay.
I know. So get a scale and it'll solve your problems.
Now, I wanted to ask about sugar cookies. These are my favorite as a kid, the sugar cookies with frosting.
Yes.
And it's amazing how much variety, I think for people using pretty similar recipes, how much variety there is in how they turn out. What is your key to a good sugar cookie?
Well, I like to use, obviously, butter for mine. And I do use a European-style butter. And that has a little bit more butter fat. So if you look at the serving size on the back of the package, if it says 12 grams per serving, that's a European-style butter, which means it has more butter fat and less liquid. And that makes, for my cookies, it makes a little crisper cookie. And that's what I really like. And the butter flavor is just so delicious.
What's that butter going to say if I'm at the store looking for that? How will I tell
Well, this is what sometimes they don't say anything. Or they'll say gourmet. They'll say European. They'll say premium. But you can always tell by flipping it over and looking at the grams per serving. Most butter, it will be 11 grams per serving. So when you get one that says 12 grams, that means it's this European style, no matter what the label says.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barbara is with us in Milwaukee. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Barbara?
When I was a little kid in Waukesha, there was Katie's mother would make a chocolate cookie and cover it with powdered sugar. It was like a disc, and it was sort of cracked on the top. Does that make sense? And do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and go ahead.
That's a chocolate crinkle, and it's called crinkle cookie. So if you want to look that up, that's what it's called, chocolate crinkle cookie. If you get a good Betty Crocker cookbook, it'll be in there.
Ah, that's funny. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Barbara. And Punky, is that going to be the one in my head? It's one that's got a little bit of a crunch on the outside, but is more squishy on the inside. Is that how those should come out?
Yes. Yeah, right. And it's you roll it in a ball and it's rolled in powdered sugar before you bake it. And then as it settles out while it's baking, it cracks on the top but stays soft inside.
All right. I hope that answers your question there, Barbara. Punky, you mentioned the classics you like to make, your favorites again and again. Do you have any, experimental models that you like to try out or give a shot come the holidays?
Well, every once in a while, I did a couple of years ago get a Pizzelle press, and that's like a really flat waffle press. And I kind of like those. It's interesting because you can make a chocolate batter for, and you can make just a vanilla. And I like them because they're fast. Now, you'd have to supervise kids because it is a hot press, but those cookies will bake out in 20 seconds. So you can make a lot of cookies in a short amount of time.
Now, you've baked a lot of cookies in your life. How many, I don't know, dozen do you end up making around holiday season? Do you mass produce, or are you just making them for, you know, a small circle here?
Well, you know, I always think I should kind of cut it down, but then I think, well, I don't know. I have a lot of neighbors and friends that I want to give them to, family. So I end up probably, I don't know, maybe 20 dozen.
That's a goodly amount.
That's probably not very many.
And we mentioned freezing the dough. Now, my grandma used to make cookies around Christmas. She'd freeze some, and then when I'd come home and visit in the summer, she'd surprise me with some Christmas cookies. Any favorite cookies that last well in the freezer?
Now, is this already baked, Robert?
Oh, they're already baked, yeah.
It's already baked. Well, a cookie with a lot of fat in it. So any of these cookies, actually, because there's a lot of butter in these, because that will tend to keep it from drying out so much.
Okay. Oh, that sounds great. That was a lot of times it was the sugar cookies, and those were pretty buttery.
Right, and a sugar cookie tends to have a lot of butter. Yes, so.
All right. Well, Punky, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun. I'll let you get back to your baking.
Well, Robin, hopefully you'll be baking this holiday yourself.
We're going to try whoopie pies, I think, this year for holidays. Never made them before.
I love those.
Oh, me
yes.
too. Me too.
Those are fun.
Punky Egan is a certified master baker. She's the former lead instructor for baking and pastry arts at Madison College. She joined us for a look at baking holiday cookies. You can check out a few of the recipes she shared with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. What we got? The pecan fingers, the shortbread, and the cream cheese spritz cookies. So head over there, find the recipe you might make this weekend. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, have you heard a good book lately? Join the conversation about great audiobooks and where to get them and share your favorites. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And you can keep sharing your favorite holiday cookie recipes, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Heard from a few of you over there. Love to see some pictures of what you've baked so far this year. Again, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Show us your fanciest holiday cookie creations while you're there. Yesterday on the show, we talked about the past, present, and future of postcards with author Lydia Pine. A lot of you called in with your postcard stories and memories. We heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley says, I always send postcards when I travel, especially during international travel. When I've been to Mexico or other parts of Central America, the fun is to not only acquire the postcards, but to actually locate the post office to get stamps, because it usually requires talking to locals, asking questions about where it's at, and adventuring to a new area of that town that I wouldn't have gone to otherwise. Carol says, I send them, and I love to get them. And Mary says, I'm sending two each week with jokes written on them to boost the spirits of my favorite ICU nurse, my daughter. You can keep sharing your postcard stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, new restrictions go into effect as leaders around the world sound the alarm over Omicron. That and all the biggest headlines from overseas on the weekly news roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a warning to listeners, this conversation is about mental health and will include some discussion of mental illness and suicide. The U.S. Surgeon General released a report last week warning about a crisis in youth mental health. In 2019, a third of high school students reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness, according to the report. That's a jump of 40% from 10 years earlier. And the pandemic has brought new stresses with transitions to and from remote learning, coupled with the uncertainty surrounding COVID-19. We're taking a closer look now at the factors driving this crisis in youth mental health and what parents, caregivers, and loved ones need to know. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a young person struggling with mental health concerns yourself, or are you seeing that among your friends? Have you noticed stress and anxiety rising in young people in your family or community? What effects have you seen the pandemic have on mental health for young people in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anna Moffitt is Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
And Dr. Ryan Herring is a professor and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He directs the BRAVE Research Center, which studies the brain's role in resilience and vulnerability among youth following traumatic events. Dr. Herring, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Dr. Herring, a big picture, we heard this warning call, really, from the Surgeon General here. What kind of things are we seeing in the run-up to the pandemic and since the pandemic started when it comes to trends in youth mental health?
Yeah, as you pointed out in the intro, there were already significant increases in youth mental health problems, even before the pandemic, such as increases in depression, anxiety, even suicide rates. And unfortunately, the pandemic has really exacerbated all of those things. So we're continuing to see even further increases in anxiety and depression, suicide as well, particularly in girls, increases in emergency department visits. And there's really just a tremendous need for mental health services for youth. So there's a lot of stressful factors, not just the pandemic, but other factors, racism and discrimination, that are really taking a toll on some of our most vulnerable youth.
Anna, can you talk some more about the stresses you're hearing about from young people over this last couple of years?
Sure. Well, you know, I think one of the biggest stressors is going from being in all remote learning right back into full-time in-person learning. I know it's important for people to stay connected and be in person, but I think it's been a tough transition for our youth to go through such a traumatic time and not really have a space to process that before they're kind of being put back with the same expectations of 2 years prior and not really taking into account the toll the pandemic has taken on their mental health.
Dr. Herring, some people point towards social media is, if not the cause, then an accelerant of these mental health concerns. What role do you see social media playing in this?
I think that's a really good point. The way it's accelerated and catalyzed a lot of the mental health problems for youth is really problematic, and it's being increasingly recognized that it's contributing to anxiety. The recent reports about Instagram contributing to eating disordered behavior and distortions in body image in girls. There's a lot of concern to be had around social media use. I will point out that, and many teens will tell you this too, social media does also have its advantages. So it has been a way for youth to stay connected during the pandemic, particularly when they were in lockdown at home. So I don't want to categorize it as an all bad thing. I think it's a technology and it's how it's used. So I think having that conversation and making youth and families aware of that is important.
Anna, can you talk about the role of uncertainty during the pandemic? It's one thing to have an immediate traumatic event, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but just sort of the ongoing uncertainty about the future. How is that affecting kids?
It does have a negative impact on kids. It has a negative impact on everybody. As human beings, we do cherish our routines, and that is something that helps keep our mental wellness and stability. So having, these disruptions time and time again can be really destabilizing for kids and adults. And so we do see that. And, I think there's layers of uncertainty, and depending on demographic groups, you're going to see certain demographic groups facing far more uncertainties and instability than other groups. And so really being intentional about where we're putting our support as far as mental health supports and making sure we are supporting those that are going to have the greatest level of need.
We are talking about youth and mental health after a Surgeon General alert that there is a crisis in mental health among young people in this country. Anna Moffitt is with us from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herring from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. There's no doubt that the pandemic has caused a lot of havoc among our teens. My question is that historically, kids have gone through other periods of tough times. For instance, kids who survived the Holocaust, or kids who have survived, civil wars in their country, or horrible things like that. Is there data comparing those kind of historical events to what's happening now? And if our kids aren't faring as well, why might that be, and what can be done?
Donna, thanks for the call. I'll throw that one to you, Dr. Herringa.
That's a really great question, Donna. I don't know if we have all the answers. I'm sure we don't have all the answers on that yet. I'm not aware of research directly comparing the two and outcomes. And of course, there's so many different factors, the historical era, the people were in, the different countries, cultures involved. I do think maybe one thing you're hinting at is that kids are also capable of a great degree of resilience. And if we can build those structures and supports around them, and like Anna was talking about earlier, give support to particularly those families who are particularly in need, I think that can go a long way. Another aspect of this is to what degree the family life and family structure has been disrupted. We talk about the problems of youth mental illness, but this is really COVID in particular has had effects on the entire family and on communities. And I think if we can really support caregivers, parents, and communities, that will have a tremendous impact on teens, on children, for helping them to not only survive and cope, but ideally even to come through this with resilience and even stronger.
Thanks for that call, Donna, at 800-642-1234. Anna, on that issue of support, I wanted to ask, I assume there are maybe resources we don't have, but what kind of resources are there for people who, a young person experiencing a mental health concern, or their family members to reach out to?
Well, I would certainly encourage folks to reach out to a local NAMI affiliate or NAMI Wisconsin. We have affiliates all across the state. So I think our organization is a great starting point to help families and kids get connected with more local resources. And of course, if you have somebody struggling in crisis, using crisis lines, using or texting 741 and use a text crisis line. So just reaching out. There's a lot of variability across the state as far as services and supports. And we know within our rural areas, it's a big problem. But with that being said, there are supports out there. So I would really get familiar with what's in your community locally. I really encourage children and youth and family members and caregivers to be proactive. Even if nobody is struggling with a mental health condition at this point in time, find out what's available, because things can change quite rapidly. And it's good to be proactive and be prepared.
We're talking to Anna Moffitt with NAMI Dane County and Dr. Ryan Herringa, expert in youth psychiatry at UW-Madison. With us today to talk about a new report from the U.S. Surgeon General about a crisis in youth mental health, a crisis that started pre-pandemic, according to a lot of the data out there. The pandemic, of course, not helping matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's tough to talk about mental health in your family or your community? Have you found a good way to talk about it in your own family? Do you have a local resource you would point toward as something that helped maybe you or someone you know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about youth mental health. Anna Moffitt from NAMI Dane County stays with us, along with Dr. Ryan Herringa from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Jacob with us in Chippewa Falls. Jacob, hi. Are you there, Jacob? Bye. I think we've lost Jacob, but thanks for giving it a shot. Well, Dr. Herringa, I know you focus in your work in part on young people have been through a trauma of some sort, a traumatic situation, and trying to help build resilience. What kind of things do help foster that kind of resilience you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, there are a number of things that I think can help youth and families to help kids thrive and to get through really stressful and traumatic situations. Certainly one of the biggest factors is social support and making sure that youth have an opportunity to be in a supportive school, that the family has the resources they need. That may mean addressing things like housing and food insecurity and financial insecurity as well, which Congress certainly tried to do, at least at some level. There are also, I think, other factors such as peer support groups. Anna talked a lot too about, or NAMI is an incredible organization with a lot of supports and guidance available. But really reaching out to sort of the natural supports that youth and families may have. Maybe that's a religious organization the family belongs to. You know, maybe it's a neighborhood community center. It could be a coach or a teacher, a school counselor. So I think really it's important to bring in those supports, and also for families to really have those conversations to the extent that they can, to check in with each other and see how everybody's doing. And the last thing I'll add is for caregivers, for families, to really not hesitate to get support for yourselves. It's caregiving, parenting is an incredibly hard job and has become so much harder during the pandemic. And so I'm hoping for parents, for caregivers, that the bar would be lowered to get themselves some help as well, to bring some compassion and being open to getting that help and guidance. We all need it.
And I wanted to ask about the role of peers in particular for that, say, a high school student who's worried about a friend based on in-person interaction or what they're seeing in social media. What kind of things can peers think about and be aware of to at least try to help?
I think peers are such an important piece, especially when we're talking about adolescents. And so really, if you have a friend who you think may be struggling based on stuff that you're seeing in social media or behaviors or conversations, is to really not be afraid to be upfront and just acknowledge what you're noticing about maybe their behaviors, their thoughts, or their feelings, and to let them know that you're concerned and that you want to help and that you will be there for them. I think just being open and honest and having that conversation. I would also too, as far as peers, if you have a friend and they disclose something like thinking about or planning to take their life, that would be a conversation that you would most definitely have to pass on to a trusted adult. And so it's important for peers to support each other, but it's also important to reach out to a trusted adult if you have significant concerns for your friend.
Go back to our callers. We've got Jacob back at Chippewa Falls. Jacob, I'm sorry. I think that was on our end, but I think we have you now. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
So I'm just wondering when the cost of mental health starts to outweigh the cost of COVID. As far as I understand, currently the death rate of COVID is still less than 1%. And I don't know what the statistics are for suicide and significant mental health costs or costs associated with mental health. But I'm wondering, at what point do we say, hey, the cost of mental health and the issues that are being caused by COVID, and not that mental health is only caused by COVID, but I'm wondering how has it changed since the pandemic? And at what point do we, as a public health official, say, here, now this is a much bigger issue that we're causing or that we're intensifying compared to the risks associated with this pandemic that we're still apparently in?
Jacob, thanks for the call. Dr. Herring, it can be tough with 800,000 deaths. Those all have a mental health impact potentially on young people as well. How do you try to balance out mental health impacts of COVID measures versus the public health measures that we need?
Jacob brings up a really good point that it's a tough balance to strike, right? The scale on which COVID is acting and the number of people dying, you know, takes obviously a tremendous toll on families. And, you know, for many youth, they've lost a caregiver or, you know, loved family member or a friend. And that's really, really hard for one's mental health. I think one area we've seen this really change this year in terms of really striking a balance between trying to mitigate and at least slow down the spread of COVID and protecting youth mental health is in the schools. And most schools are now operating back in person if they have been closed. And that's really based on increasing evidence that school closures and remote learning are really not good for kids. They're not good generally for kids' education. And we're finding out it's not good for kids' mental health to be remote and not interacting with peers in person. Certainly there are special cases for children who may have vulnerable immune systems or special learning needs where, you know, where different situations apply. But I think that's a really good example of where public health has struck a balance between trying to keep kids at school when at all possible, while certainly doing everything else that they can, including distancing and masking, to try to minimize the spread of COVID.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Anna, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line talking about the cost of mental health care in some cases. It's easy to say, seek some kind of professional help. How are we doing when it comes to A, access to that kind of help, and B, the affordability of help people might need?
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, as far as access, I would argue that we're not doing a very good job. I mean, especially when we're looking at children and youth, only about 50% of children and youth with a diagnosis actually are accessing treatment. So that, you know, means one in two people aren't getting treatment. So we really need to explore why that's happening. Of course, cost, access to healthcare is a barrier for a lot of families, as well as wait times for getting services. So I think it's something that needs to be addressed more by, and I would even say by government levels, because we're talking about bigger systems. It's not an issue that can, you know, be resolved by different small groups working on it. It really is like a systemic issue that needs to be addressed. But the numbers don't bear out well. And even looking at when someone is diagnosed, it's usually about 10 years until they're in treatment. And so really figuring out why that's happening, because we know the earlier we intervene and provide treatment, the greater outcomes, the better recovery journey that people will have, especially our children and youth.
Dr. Herringer, looking to the future, are there things that make you hopeful that we can deal with this trend, this problem of youth mental health concerns, again, that started before the pandemic? Any bright spots that you see out there?
I do see some positive trends. I think the increasing emphasis and awareness, for one, on mental health problems and a willingness to talk about those is really a good sign. And, you know, part of the, I think one of the questions underlying the rise of mental health problems is our youth simply more willing to talk about this, maybe than previous generations even. Social media, you know, we talked about the harms it can do. I think there's also a lot of potential there to do good in terms of helping youth feel connected with peers, connecting them with mental health services, and even being able to screen youth in a more automatic way, you know, giving pop-ups for crisis lines, for example, when they might post certain things. So I think there is promise there if we can do it right. I also think some of the increasing attempts at building in wellness practices and skills in the schools, I think, can really do a lot of good. And these can be things like having peer support within the schools, doing or having meditation or mindfulness related classes, you know, building in exercise and nutrition and guidance about sleep. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do. I think, like Anna was saying, some of these need to be implemented at scale on a bigger level, and so may take action really from the state or federal government to really, really begin to move the needle.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Anna Moffitt, Executive Director of NAMI Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herringa, Professor and Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Coming up Monday on Central Time, why do we humans dream? We'll get some of the different theories to explain that sleep mystery. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up, out of concern over COVID-19, more millennials are starting to write their wills. We'll get some advice on how to do that at any age and take care of other estate planning related matters coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.